What do a new policy, low-cost competitor, and a social movement have in common? All three require tension.
Tension is a side effect of change. If you want to make sure people are going to get on the train before it leaves, you got to toot the whistle. What does the whistle do? It creates tension. You better get on the train. It's leaving. That is what moves people forward.
That's Seth Godin, who many of you may already know for his advice on business and marketing. Seth is an entrepreneur, best-selling author, podcaster, teacher, speaker, and a world-renowned expert on creativity and creative entrepreneurship. He's launched one of the most popular blogs in the world and written 20 best-selling books, including The Dip, Lynchpin, Purple Cow, Tribes, and What to Do When It's Your Turn. And it's always your turn. His 2018 book, This Is Marketing, was an instant bestseller in many countries. Seth's most recent book, The Practice, Shipping Creative Work, is a handbook for creative professionals looking to make and share their work. Though renowned for his writing and speaking, Seth also founded two companies, Squidoo and Yoyodyne, which was acquired by Yahoo. He is also the founder of the acclaimed Akimbo Workshop platform and the wildly popular 30-day Alt-MBA course. Seth has motivated and inspired people worldwide with his ideas about marketing, leadership, and the spread of ideas, among many topics. In 2013, Seth was inducted into the Marketing Hall of Fame, as well as the Direct Marketing Hall of Fame.
Creativity is simply the human act of doing something that might not work and doing it on behalf of other people. That's what we call creativity. It has nothing to do with whether you know how to use a paintbrush or not.
I'm Meryl MacDonald, and my passion is helping people and organizations navigate the human struggle of change. I believe that when we relinquish control, we open up amazing new possibilities. This podcast, Let Go and Lead, is about what happens when we loosen the reins. In it, I speak with business leaders, academics, and creative thinkers to hear about their career and life journeys and to gather what they've learned about change, transformation, and creativity along the way. And now, Seth Godin. So Seth, I'm so honored to welcome you to our Let Go and Lead community. You've been such an inspiration to so many with your blogs, your books, TED Talks, entrepreneurship, and really simply just by being you.
Oh, you're very kind. It's good to talk to you.
We thought about so many things we could ask you and so many directions we could go in, but really what I'd love to talk to you about is the whole concept of reinvention and really what that word means to you and why it's so relevant for today's companies.
So I saw a note online where someone was complaining about a job interview they went to. And in the job interview, one of the questions in writing was, you're given an elephant and you're not allowed to sell it or give it away. What will you do? And it led to a very spirited debate about whether this was a fair question or not, and a bunch of creative alternatives. But what I thought was fascinating is the people who said, it's a gift. You don't have to accept it. That's what makes it a gift. And the idea of sunk costs are really hard for people to get their arms around. Sunk costs are things we worked hard for, things we invested in, things that maybe we even suffered to get, but we don't need them anymore. They get in the way of our ability to make a good decision. And a lot of people, I mean, it's the only real important thing that they teach you in business school, as far as I'm concerned, but a lot of people have trouble with this. And the reason they have trouble with this is because it's hard to let go, not just of an elephant, but of a law degree, of senior vice president title, of a plant that was built at great expense across the river in Fayetteville. All of these things are sunk costs. And the way to think about them is they are a gift from your former self. And you don't have to accept it any more than you have to accept the elephant. And if we can do that and say, no, thank you, we're not really reinventing. What we're doing is making a new decision based on new information.
That's so interesting. And you mentioned you learn a lot of this in business school, and it makes me think about just organizations today and what they're trying to do is everybody's talking about transforming, right? And what do you think most companies need to let go of to reinvent themselves?
I think they need to let go of the illusion that they are competent and that they will remain competent. Because number one, being competent isn't worth very much, because networks, computers, AI redefines generic as something that's pretty cheap. And number two is, going forward, the rest of the world doesn't care that you used to be competent. And so the phrase, this might not work, you're not supposed to say that at work. But if you don't say that at work, you've got no chance. I mean, Steve Ballmer, one of the worst CEOs in modern history, was persistently and consistently wrong, partly because he was unable to say, this might not work. He had to be certain, which meant that he missed every one of the major tech innovations of the last 15 years.
In this, of course, you're such an entrepreneur. A lot of being an entrepreneur is really getting out and trying things and experimenting. And what's been your process as you've really thought about the tasks that you take on?
Well, there's an outsider's view that entrepreneurs are risk takers. Entrepreneurs are not risk takers. Entrepreneurs do everything they can to minimize risk. I remember 20, 30 years ago, 10,000 people at Ford Motor Company lost their job in a layoff. All of them. Was it their fault that Ford was making a lousy SUV that no one wanted to buy? No. They just had a really risky job. And their job was that at any minute they could lose it because someone who wasn't them was making a decision that might not work. And what an entrepreneur seeks to do is to make smaller bets and to make them with a sense of control, because if you know it might not work, you can protect against the downside.
And that kind of reminded me, as you were talking about putting, you know, being risky because you're dependent on someone else, of, you know, your whole point of no one's going to pick you. You have to pick yourself, and believing in yourself.
Right. And I think those might be two different things. So let's break them into pieces. It used to be that you needed to be picked by an investor, by a book publisher, by Dick Clark to be on the radio, by the folks at ABC to be on television. And so we spent a lot of time raising kids and grooming ourselves to get picked for the good job, get picked for the soccer team. And now we just blew it all up. And if you want to be on TV, well, you can have your own YouTube channel. If you want to have your own podcast, oh, look, you do have your own podcast. You can pick yourself. That is not the same thing as finding confidence, which might be mistaken for being sure it's going to work. Most of the creators I know, and I wrote about a lot of them in my book, The Practice, do their best work when they have no confidence. They're just noodling. They're reaching out of the boat. They're being generous, but they're not willing to bet everything that's going to work. Their job is to create something new. And then by definition, that means they can't be sure.
If people start with creating something new, what do you think is the spark for that?
The most successful people I know are trying to solve a problem they wish somebody else would solve.
You know, one of the things we talk about in part of Let Go and Lead is the whole idea of capturing the imagination. Do you see that fitting into your concept?
Whose imagination are we trying to capture?
Well, I think first your own and then others that follow you. And I know this might be an interesting time to talk about your concept of a taco.
Okay, so lots of people have something funny to say. Lots of people have something generous to say. Lots of people have something innovative to do, but they don't. And one of the things that separates the successful creator from those folks is they say it out loud. So in your words, that's capturing the imagination. A lot of people will deny that they have an imagination. I just don't have any good ideas, they'll say. Well, actually, what they should be honest about is they don't have enough bad ideas. They aren't comfortable enough with bad ideas to be able to blurt out an idea that might become a good one. And so entrepreneurs are better at blurting things out. And otaku is a Japanese word that was originally used derisively, but I have embraced it to use it with pride, which is, what do we call somebody who's truly a nerd, who cares deeply about, I don't know, how their stereo sounds and can tell the difference between one cable and another, who understands the difference between a large diaphragm microphone and one with a traditional capacitor inside of it, whatever it is, that the idea of otaku is you're not doing this because it's your job. You're doing it because you care.
A lot of our listeners are people who are leading transformations in large companies. do you see a way of taking the otaku concept and utilizing it for them?
Yeah, I think the most important thing I can say to them is this. There is no such thing as change management. Change management is a trap, and the words give it away. Because management is using power and authority to get what you want, to tell people what to do because you know if they do it, it's going to work. So a fast food restaurant needs a manager because if not, no one would show up for their shift. And organizations with hierarchies have managers, but change cannot be managed. It can only be led. And leadership is different than management. Leadership is voluntary, and leadership comes with no guarantees, which means that it's voluntary for you to decide to be a leader. You can simply be a manager and not lead, but if you do that, you're not going to succeed. And if you're a follower, you can choose to follow someone who's doing change leadership. But if you're required to follow them, there's a disconnect because then it's management. And when we do change leadership, we have two key elements. One, we are happy and eager to say, this might not work. Because if we were really sure, well, then we would have done it already. And two, we're able to invite people to enroll in the journey as opposed to ordering them to comply. And so most of the tension I see in the people you're describing are they think they do change management, but they can't.
Yeah, and we are such kindred spirits on that because as we work with our clients, we're always talking about that concept of the two different things. But it's interesting that many people use the terms interchangeably, which just shows you how far we have to go.
But it gives me something to do because I'm the first person who talked about the difference and I could rant about it all day long.
Yeah, that's terrific. What do you think holds back leaders from reinventing themselves?
Well, the thing is that part of what it means to be a leader, because you are pointing somewhere in the future where you cannot be sure, is that deep down you know that you are an imposter. And imposter syndrome is real. And a lot of people will try to teach you how to not feel like an imposter. But in the practice, what I write about is, why not just embrace it and realize that the more you feel like an imposter, the more likely it is you're actually leading. And so one thing that keeps competent managers from becoming leaders is they just can't bear to feel like an imposter. And that's what gets in the way.
And what do you recommend to overcome that or to embrace it, I guess, as you're saying?
If you watch the Boston Marathon, what you will see is that a whole bunch of people drop out at mile 20 or 21. And fewer people finish at mile 26. And what's the difference? Well, the difference is they're all tired, but the people who dropped out at mile 21 couldn't figure out where to put the tired. It became overwhelming. The people who finished were in just as good shape. They just knew where to put the tired. And so when we think about the tired of imposter syndrome, the fear of being wrong, the confusion about management versus leadership, it's pretty simple. I can't make the tired go away. All I can do is point out it exists, and maybe you could learn where to put it.
This makes me think about Margaret Wheatley, who talks about the importance of leaders being hosts, not heroes, and not having all the answers, but embracing people and really opening themselves up to everyone's ideas. Is that part of what you're talking about or not? Is it a different concept?
The thing is, if you get on a bus that's going to Shaker Heights, Ohio, the driver announces before you get on the bus where it's going, and the driver is responsible. The driver has authority. The driver is not open to suggestions, and the bus will get there just as fast if the passengers are quiet than if the passengers speak up. Being a bus driver is an act of management. But leadership requires enrollment and leadership requires contribution because you are seeking possibility. So that doesn't mean every decision is a democratic tally, but it does mean that you are more likely to lead by listening than you are by giving orders.
I know you've often encouraged people to go make a ruckus. What's the future for you? What will you make a ruckus over next?
So let me tell you what I mean by ruckus. It's an old word. I love the way it's spelled. It's pretty good for Scrabble because you can use up two U's with one play. I define a ruckus as a generous commotion. showing up to make things better by making better things, showing up by speaking useful truths, showing up by doing more than your fair share so that others will pitch in. That's what I mean by making a ruckus. And for me, I'm a freelancer. I am not a manager. I have been an entrepreneur several times in my career. I helped invent email marketing a very long time ago. I built one of the first internet companies a very long time ago. And over the last 5 years, I built a learning institution called Akimbo that includes the Alt MBA. But I don't run it anymore. I don't own it. And it's not mine. It's a B Corp. And I have spun it out to the people in that company because I need to get back to doing what I do that's sort of unique, which is solving an interesting problem and doing it with the leverage that comes from not having a big team, but instead figuring out how to turn a good idea into a big idea. And I have no clue what my next one is, none, but I need to leave some empty space so I can find it.
Leaving empty space is a really important concept, you know, and so many leaders today, as you know, just are so full that there's no space at all. And I'm sure as you talk to creative communities, this is part of the challenge there as well. What do you recommend?
If a manager is doing their job, they're completely booked. They're full. If a leader is doing their job, they're not doing any managing. So if you are feeling full, it might be because you lack the discipline to hire management. What leaders do is something fundamentally different, and it's addictive to answer email for 2 hours and to have people who are counting on you for quick answers and to, you know, tell the boat to turn left or to turn right. That's your manager's job. Your job is to build a culture, to engage with people, to figure out where you're going to find new volunteers, to earn more enrollment, to see things that other people don't see, to describe where you're trying to go. And if your organization has any scale whatsoever, that means you should not be taking custom cake orders on the phone. You should not be dealing with angry customers and down the list and down the list. You can do those things if you want to because you're going to learn something. But those are jobs that are best done by managers and by people with skills that are different than what a leader needs.
This is getting right at the heart of what is normally my last question. But because, of course, this podcast is called Let Go and Lead, I'm curious to know what you think leaders most need to let go of.
Control. The idea, and this is a big problem for me. It has been for a long time, ever since I started as an entrepreneur. You know, if I handed in a book to Scholastic and there was a 99.9% accuracy rate in the book, it meant there was a typo on every 2 or 3 pages. Can't have that. And so part of what I needed to build a reputation was control over the process of the book so that there were zero errors. And at the beginning, I solved that problem by being the worst copy editor in the world, but spending a lot of time at it so that there were zero errors. And over time, what I realized is I have to figure out how to be creative at finding someone who's obsessed about typos and hiring that person. And the thing is that there are plenty of organizations that I used to be part of that are doing fine today without me, right? I wrote more words for Fast Company magazine than anybody, but I haven't written a word for Fast Company magazine in 20 years. They seem to be doing okay.
You seem to be doing okay too.
Right. But even without me, the magazine still comes out on time. So the point is every other organization in the world has figured out how to get by without you. So there's this one organization left. Why not give up control over some of the things and hire some people who can do work that you are not the only person in the world capable of doing?
Well, you have a remarkable ability really to tap into things that are emerging. Like I think about Medium and how you're using that. And, you know, it seems that that's really working for you now. How do you gauge the right place to be to grow?
That's a great question. So if we're going to talk about the media landscape, I think the first rule is you don't want to go where the cool kids are because the cool kids will always go to the new place and they're always going to be cooler than you. And instead, you homestead. You find a piece of property and you improve it and you improve it and you improve it and you stick with it long after the cool kids have moved on. So I did some experiments with Medium, but Medium tends to be sort of flashy in the sense that whatever's hot today gets traffic, but it gets no traffic tomorrow. And I've been on my blog now for more than 20 years. I've published 8,000 posts in a row. And some people, right as we've been talking, are reading a post I wrote 11 years ago. And that's the way you build a building. That's the way you build a trademark. That's the way you should build where you live online. And you have to change it, not when your fans say to change it or your spouse says to change it, but when your accountant says it's time to change it. That line is from my friend, the late Jay Levinson.
That's great. And what's your accountant telling you?
Well, I don't have an accountant because I'm making art projects. I'm not trying to make a living. Mm-hmm. And that enables me perversely to make a living, but I don't keep track of it. I have made $0 from my blog over more than 20 years of doing it every single day. I don't do it because it's a profitable way to spend my time. If I had spent my time buying Bitcoin, I would have come out way ahead. The thing I'm trying to do is make a point, make a difference, make a connection, not make a profit. And amazingly, in the world we live in, if you stand for something, it tends to be that making an income takes care of itself.
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in that. That's for sure. What is you, as you're going through all this, what impact do you really hope to achieve through all you create and share?
I have been paying attention to just one thing. Not how many visits I get, not how many subscribers or how many books I sell, but what do my students teach other people? Because it's that, the 10 by 10 by 10, that sideways filtering, that is how we change the culture. And I'm trying to make at least a small difference on helping people treasure other people's attention and dignity and treat other people with respect and encourage them to contribute. And I've been able to reach, you know, as many people as most authors, but the people I'm reaching are now reaching new people. And that cycle, even especially when I don't get credit, that cycle, that's the one I'm looking for.
That just has such exponential possibility. It's fantastic. And it really is all about creating a movement, right?
Yes. And there's different kinds of movements. And I wrote a book called Tribes about this. I don't have a tribe.
Right.
And you probably don't either. Instead, we get to narrate for a group of people that would be there even if we weren't. And so when a group of people, say the folks who go to Comic-Con every year, get together and talk superheroes, you have a chance to talk to them about what they're interested in. And a movement may or may not have someone at the front. You know, it's not clear to me that there's a Superman movement, but it's more likely to me that there's a movement around finding connection and possibility and belonging in a community of people that every once in a while, like Superman. And so I think the movement, which my friends Alan and Bill really put a beautiful label on when they started Press Company all those years ago, is how do human beings who care show up to make things better using new tools and new attitudes? That is the group that I am narrating for. If you're not in that group, you never heard of me, and that's fine with me.
I can't imagine someone who hasn't heard of you, but I'm sure they're out there.
Well, no, I got to interrupt you there because we should talk about this, Meryl, because in This Is Marketing, I talk about the smallest viable audience. And people roll their eyes and they say, I don't want the smallest viable audience. I want the biggest possible audience. And I say, well, how many customers do you think Coinbase has? Coinbase, which is worth $80 billion. How many good customers do you think they have? There's no way they have more than 100,000 really good customers. That's enough to be worth $80 billion. Or the fact that I've written 20 bestsellers. And yet, more than 99% of the people in the United States, just the United States, 99% plus, have never read a word I have written. And so it's fine. 1% is enough. It's plenty. But it's hard to put yourself on the hook. It's hard to say, I am only for chief learning officers. I am only for people who live in West Virginia and love the sport of cricket, whatever it is, only for them. Because then you're on the hook And you can be held responsible for serving the people you said you wanted to serve.
Do you think that frightens people?
Oh, yeah. Responsibility, it's interesting. In organizations, people fight for it, but they also fear it because they think that it will get them in trouble. And it usually goes with authority, which makes people feel safe. If you have authority, you get to tell people what to do. And what I'm arguing is you're not going to get any authority. But if you take responsibility, they'll give you all of that you can handle.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of so many people where we've seen that over and over again, right? It's sort of related to the concept of if you want something done, give it to the really busy person, but busy meaning productive.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that people over and over who just, you know, grab the opportunity and go with it by being brave.
Exactly. But again, brave and risk, they're similar words in the sense that the safest thing you can do is be brave. Because the people who think they're avoiding something that's going to get them in trouble are the first that are going to be shown the door.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I was thinking of brave as like knowing there's going to be things that don't go right, but doing it anyway.
Right. We're agreeing.
Yeah.
That the one who's just bystanding and covering their ass and sending long memos. Well, when it's time for layoffs, and it will be again, are we going to get rid of the person who is regularly in the vanguard and making things better and taking appropriate risks? Or are we going to get rid of the deadwood who's only been around because no one's had the guts to get rid of them before?
Right. You know, switching tacks, one of your recent posts on Medium, you talked about that in order to create change, you have to create tension first. I'd love to hear more about that.
Right. So this is another thing that I've written about in the last two books, in This is Marketing and The Practice, which is that tension is not a bad thing. Tension is a side effect of change. If you want to shoot a rubber band across the room, the only way to do it is to pull it backwards. If you want to make sure people are going to get on the train before it leaves, you got to toot the whistle. What does the whistle do? It creates tension. You better get on the train. It's leaving. That is what moves people forward. And so we willingly inflict tension on people because they are willingly accepting it because they do want to move forward, but the status quo has been fighting to keep them in place. And so as long as after the fact, the person is willing to say thank you, there's nothing wrong with inflicting tension. It's the people who manipulate us. Those people are hustlers and no one wants to be hustled. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is living with the pain of the shot because the vaccine is worth it.
As you think about organizations and the changes they're trying to go through, what are some of the ways you see them creating tension?
Well, okay, so the tension is usually created externally because a change agent arrives, a low-cost competitor, a new policy at a website, a social movement. These things swamp the organization that's been working overtime to keep things the same. And so now tension exists. And the tension is usually around affiliation or status. Affiliation, who likes us, who's with us, who are we in sync with, what are our competitors doing, how do we remain fitting in? Or status, who's up, who's down, who's winning, who's losing, who's going to get this big contract, who's not. And when status and affiliation are under threat or an opportunity, then the organization realizes that individuals will feel that tension because individuals care about status. Individuals care about affiliation, and it ripples through the whole organization. And, you know, Jack Welch, who was a bit of a barbarian, created tension by saying 10% of the people in every department get fired at the end of the year. Well, that certainly doesn't create teamwork because as long as someone's slower than you, you're fine, right? But clearly tension in the room because nobody can risk being last. And there are much better, more productive, and more humane ways to create tension among a team. But if there is no tension, then expect that people are going to do what they did yesterday.
So I would like to follow up on that because this is such an interesting topic. What are some of the more productive, humane ways?
So is the pie limited? Is it finite? Or can the pie get bigger? So when you think about how many people work at an organization, if they get on a growth path, you don't have to lay off 10% of the people. You have to hire 10% more people because the pie is getting bigger. The network effect, part of the magic of the internet, is that the more people who use something, the more valuable it is. creates value in and of itself. And so contributing to a community, something like Wikipedia or Linux or any number of projects, actually goes up in value as more people do it. So instead of it being the tension of scarcity, it's the tension of abundance. It's hurry up, because the more of us start dancing in this field, the more fun the party's going to be.
That's, I think, too often of companies where you see some of the most successful ones embrace their competitors so that they could really grow the market.
Right. And so this is a brilliant insight on your part. Let's talk about positioning for a minute. One model is you can pick anyone. And the problem with that slogan is that's a race to the bottom. Because if I can pick anyone, I'll pick the cheapest one. Why do I need you? The alternative is to say, if you're the kind of person that's looking for blank, blank is exactly what we do. So if you walk into an Hermes store on, you know, Rue Faubert in Paris and say, hi, I'm looking for a $6 headscarf, they don't try to upsell you to a 500 euro headscarf. They say, oh, there's a great $6 headscarf place just around the corner. That doesn't hurt them. That helps them, because they're not there for you and you're not here for them. And so what I would say to an organization that pretends they understand their position, I would say the following question. How often do you send prospects to organizations that you might think of as your competition? Because if you're not busy sending people somewhere else, then you're not being honest about the fact that you have a position. So that's why authors blurb other authors' books all the time, because they're not busy saying, no, buy my book instead. They're saying, if you're looking for a book that's a history of the Palm Pilot, this is the book to read. Because if that's what you're looking for, I don't have a book like that. This guy does.
And, you know, I just love the whole generous spirit of the community in general, the way people support one another.
Yes.
So let's talk about authors. Your book, The Practice, gives such great advice. And, you know, one of it, of course, is all around giving advice about how to be professional in a creative role. But I'm wondering, given that so many leaders also need to innovate and may not think of themselves as creatives, what advice do you have for them?
Well, there's so much to decode here. What does it mean to be a creative? You mean good at Photoshop and a Wacom tablet? Do you mean capable of standing up and giving a stem winding speech? There's so many forms of creativity, and many of them have nothing to do with art, with graphics, with design, with public performance. That, you know, if we just look at what Satoshi, whoever that is, created almost $1 trillion worth of value by writing an 8-page memo, I think most of us would agree there was some creativity involved in that. That if you win the Fields Medal in math, you have done something creative, even though almost nobody else can understand it. Creativity is simply the human act of doing something that might not work and doing it on behalf of other people. That's what we call creativity. It has nothing to do with whether you know how to use a paintbrush or not.
That's a great definition. I love that. So in that case, this kind of comes back to what you were talking about earlier of leaders being really recognizing that as a leader, you need to try things that might not work.
Well, if you don't, then why would you expect the people who work with you to do it?
Right. What's the hardest thing you've tried to do and feel you didn't get it over the finish line?
Oh, the list is really, really long. I'm so proud of how many failures I've had. They are the defining element of my ability to contribute. I've had more failures than almost anyone I've ever met, because sometimes they're failures of sloth in that if I had just worked harder, it would have worked. Usually, they are failures of judgment in the sense that I didn't see what other people were seeing. So I was running an internet company before the World Wide Web. And when the World Wide Web showed up, I saw it before almost anybody. And instead of starting Yahoo, I wrote a book about the internet that sold 1,800 copies. And so that was a $40 billion mistake right there. And there's been nonprofits I've worked with, and there have been people I've coached and things I've tried to understand or contribute to where it only came too late to me what the method that might have worked would have been. And, you know, so, you know, at school, you cheat on a test by looking into somebody on somebody else's paper. In life, you cheat by waiting for somebody else to go first and then seeing what they did. And going first is scary, but if you don't, who will?
One of the things I love just and I've heard it several times in the conversation today is how forgiving you are of yourself and of your failures and the things that you've tried to do. And it sounds like it's because you hold yourself to a really high standard of continuing to try and create. Am I getting that right?
I think that's part of it. I have really critical standards about failures of kindness and failures of contribution and failures of bravery in the face of doing something generous. I beat myself up about those three things all the time.
My one last question is there anything I should have asked you and didn't?
These have been fantastic questions, really well thought through and generous. We didn't talk at all about dark chocolate, style canoeing, Algonquin Park up in Canada. We didn't talk about cannibal jokes. There's so many things that we could save for the next time we chat. But I guess where I will leave this is we've all been indoctrinated into a hierarchy, indoctrinated around privilege, indoctrinated around industrial capitalism and doing what we're told. But now industrial capitalism is fading really fast and you don't owe it anything. And in this moment, we have a chance to make things better by making better things, not to defend the status quo. And it's people like you that are helping lead the charge for folks who have leverage and trust and the benefit of the doubt to say, not on my watch. Let's change this right here and right now.
Amen to everything you just said. And the other thing I'm going to say amen to is you did open the door for me asking you to come back. I just want to thank you. It's been so fantastic, Seth. It was so interesting to hear Seth's take on reinvention, creativity, and leadership. Here are a few of my takeaways. First, our past achievements can get in the way when we're making decisions about a new direction. In a sense, those accomplishments are sunk costs, which in business refers to money spent that can't be recovered and shouldn't factor into future decisions. Seth says that in leading change, sunk costs can show up in things like former degrees or titles that no longer serve us. We must let go of these sunk costs, Seth says. Think of them as gifts from our former selves and move forward by operating on the new relevant information we have. Second, it's common for us as individuals to feel like imposters, and that's okay. Seth suggests that we embrace imposter syndrome instead of trying to squash it. He believes that the more you feel like an imposter, the more likely it is that you're leading because no one else has been in your position and can show you the exact steps. Third, successful creators are comfortable sharing their ideas and perspectives, unlike others who let fear hold them back. By being in the habit of sharing, they're more likely to see one of their ideas come to life. For business leaders, the lesson is to get comfortable with sharing new or different ideas more often. Seth points out that it's also essential to be clear with others that an idea may not work, but if you don't explore it at all, then there's no chance of it becoming successful. Four is you consider where in our ever-evolving media landscape to share your ideas, don't go where the cool kids are. Seth recommends homesteading instead, meaning that you find a place that's right for you, you improve it and stay with it. That's how you build your brand. Last, among his many failures, including his $40 billion Yahoo mistake, Seth is most critical about failings of kindness, contribution, and bravery. He considers failure in terms of character traits, not tangible misses. That's because Seth believes you can fail in reaching your goals, but not in modeling your character. That's a great reminder to us all. Thank you, Seth, for sharing your wisdom. It was truly an honor. And thanks to all of you for listening. Until next time, this is Let Go and Lead.